Gun violence is a major problem across the country and here in Iowa. Cedar Rapids community leaders are looking for solutions. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, Mason City's plans to increase hog production, how better information technology can lessen food insecurity, do energy-efficient LED street lamps create more light pollution, a spring severe weather outlook, and Ecopolis, where art and community activism come together. Buckle up for your NewsBuzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick news conversations to end this week. Last weekend in Cedar Rapids, two people died in separate gun-related incidents, and now leaders in that community are looking for answers and for hope. On Monday, Cedar Rapids hosted a gathering to discuss the violence and what could be done to prevent future tragedies. Diedrich Doolin was there, and he joins me now. Diedrich Doolin, Cedar Rapids branch president of the NAACP, also director of the Area Substance Abuse Council. Diedrich, welcome to our program, and I understand we reach you on a day when you're attending a funeral of one of the young men who was shot.
Yes, in about just over an hour from now.
Tell us about the meeting on Monday. What were your takeaways from it as people in the community shared their concerns?
Well, actually, it was a press conference, and the purpose of the press conference was to try to get a message out citywide, community-wide, that that what's going on in our community with violence is not just a one neighborhood or one community or with one race of people or one group of people. It's a citywide problem that we need to have citywide participation in solutions, and not just pointing fingers and you know, complaining. And we can talk all day, but we need the whole community. So that's what we were trying to do. We were we had organized these people, called in several people to try to come together from all walks of life within this community. And we're hoping that we can get, you know, everyone's involvement from you know, law enforcement, from parents and adults, you know, youth, churches, businesses, agencies, organizations, you know, everybody sort of working together and not just thinking that there's a simple solution to this, but the solution is us coming together.
Mm-hmm.
We are hoping that we can also get neighbors to be real neighbors and to speak to each other, to be nice to each other, to be respectful. But we also realize that we've got to teach people how to resolve conflicts and disagreements without violence.
Right.
So this is what we were hoping to accomplish with this.
Did
we still have more work to do.
Yeah.
Yes,
I just want to know, you say it's a citywide problem. Do these incidents of gun violence have a common root that you discussed at the conference?
Well, we think that part of the common root, unfortunately, is that many folks don't understand how to resolve conflict without violence. All these incidents of violence are not necessarily connected to one another. But, and this is not a, you know, the impression that some people have is this is a problem that just started. This problem didn't just start. This problem has been building for a number of years, and we've had some problems for a number of years, and it's just been building and building. And we haven't gotten to the point where we've been able to turn it off. And so, you know, like any situation, if the problem is not resolved or addressed, you know, even like with a health issue, it gets worse. And that's what we see that's happening in this community. Across the city, it's not like the shootings only happen in one neighborhood or one part of the city. And we just got to get the message out that, you know, guns and violence are not the way. You know, we think that, in my opinion, even some of the things that are happening, you know, in media today with the presidential campaigns, just the, you know, the aggressiveness, the anger and the disrespect that we've seen this year in the presidential campaigns is just kind of an example of the unfortunate messages that children and people in the community are receiving about how to resolve conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and unfortunately, too many people want to, when they feel disrespected, they want to get violent, and that's not the way to resolve someone disrespecting you. But those are the messages that are being sent to our young folks and to our adults in our community. Like I said, even through the presidential campaign this year, which has been very unfortunate that we see this. But there are other messages in the community that need to be clear. And you know, if people haven't learned how to resolve conflicts, they're going to resolve them the only way they know how.
Right. I understand, and just like you alluded to in the presidential campaign, social media is involved in the presidential campaign. And I understand from your press conference on Monday that people in the community feel these are arguments that often start in social media and then get carried out onto the streets with guns.
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, there's no question that the social media has made this situation worse, and that there are a lot of things that are happening in social media. The unfortunate reality is social media is one of those ways that people can just attack other people without, you know, being face to face. And you know, some people have a little bit more courage to say things and do things on social media, and then it just sort of dominoes. And we really gotta get a handle on it. And once again, like I said, you know, we're really hoping that our community can realize our community is like a body. You know, the body cannot, the legs can't go one direction, and the arms go another direction. The eyes can't go one direction, ears go another direction. We need the community to come together. So that's what we were hoping to accomplish with that press conference is get that message out and get everybody to realize if any child or adult is in danger in our community, everybody's at risk. My children, your children. And so we're hoping that people won't look at this as not my problem. Because if you go down the street and bullets don't have eyes and they don't necessarily go where they're aimed, you could be in danger. And we're just trying to get everybody on board to do their part to make our community a safer and better place for everyone.
So you're trying to get the message out. What happens now in terms of concrete steps that you're hoping for, aside from awareness raising? You talked about neighbors being neighbors.
Right, right. And so basically, that was not the end all of what we need to do. And understand, there are already efforts, and there have already been efforts, and there already are some real good things that are going on in the community. The problem is that it's not reaching everybody, and you know, there's still pockets and people that are not being reached. And so that's what we were hoping to do is to initiate that, and then we've got to do some more planning. We've got to do some more coming together. The other thing that I see is that there are a lot of initiatives that are going on in this community that are trying to resolve this problem. There are a lot of different segments and individuals and organizations and groups and businesses, law enforcement, that are trying to resolve this problem. We're hoping that we can connect all those things and that the right hand and the left hand know what they're doing, and we don't have a lot of duplication. But we also know that no one individual, no one group, no one business, no one agency can reach everybody. So we've got to try to reach everybody and help everybody to realize that they can be part of the solution, mm-hmm. not just part of the problem.
Do gun laws or a lack of gun laws, certain gun laws, have a role here in the increasing gun violence?
I personally feel that the lackadaisical message that, you know, guns are okay, and that's not to say that people shouldn't buy guns and have guns, but there's some people that really should not have access to guns. And the message that, you know, that I think people in the community receive is, you know, guns is the way to go. And so I think there's a strong backing for supporting guns and people having guns, but we really have to look at gun laws and not have guns so easily accessible. Kids don't make guns. How many kids do you know have a gun shop? So how do kids get guns? That's an issue, you know, and kids that are not old enough to buy guns, you know, are getting illegal guns. Some of those are happening from, you know, kids stealing guns or kids getting guns from adults. I've heard messages of parents or adults that say, well, my child or my sibling needs to have a gun to protect himself. That's not the message. We've got to change that thinking in our community.
Diedrich Doolin, Cedar Rapids Branch President of the NAACP, also Director of the Area Substance Abuse Council. Diedrich Doolin, thank you for this conversation.
Okay, thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A North Carolina-based company has announced plans to build a 10,000-head capacity hog processing plant in Mason City. It's a move that would make the company the biggest taxpayer, not only in the city of Mason City, but also in Cerro Gordo County. And here to discuss the implications of this, Amy Mayer, agriculture reporter with Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Ben.
A big investment here, $240 million. Who's investing this much in a plant, and what lured them to Mason City?
The company is called Prestige Farms, and their operations in Iowa are Prestige Foods of Iowa. They already work with a lot of hog farmers here, and part of the incentive was for them to have a processing plant where those farmers they work with would bring all their hogs. As for their interest in Mason City, the way it was described, they contacted some of the elected officials and some of the Economic Development Corporation officials in Mason City last December and said Mason City was on a short list. And in working with them over the past couple of months, Mason City rose to the top. I think one of the things that was mentioned by Chad Schreck, who is the head of the North Iowa Corridor Economic Development Corporation, is that Mason City had this unique situation of plenty of capacity for water. They had this water plant that they built about 10 or 15 years ago, and he said it was overbuilt with the intention that there would be growth, but it hadn't yet grown as much as it could. So all Mason City water users have been paying extra, essentially. I mean, paying what they were told to pay, but because they had to operate this plant that was bigger than they needed. And so the hog processing plant is going to need a lot of water, and they're going to come in, and the water is going to be available right away. The plant, the water processing plant, is able to do that. So that's certainly one of the infrastructure issues that was easy in Mason City. Mm-hmm. And it'll be great for water customers in Mason City because their rates are probably going to go down.
Mm-hmm. So what does this announcement mean? And give us an idea of the context here. Mean in the context of Iowa's overall hog production, when we say this is a 10,000-head capacity hog processing plant. How Iowa's the leader here in hog processing and raising hogs, slaughtering them. How does this fit into the bigger picture?
You're right. Iowa has been the leader in hog production. Since 2008, Iowa's produced at least 30% of all the hogs in the country. So it has sustained that since then. There are a bunch of processing plants in the state, but there's desire on the part of producers to grow the hog population even more. And one of the conditions that needed to be met was additional processing capacity. And so this plant will do that. The way Prestige presented it, they expect their own hogs to immediately fulfill 50% of the plant's capacity, and then they would be able to buy hogs, the other half, from other producers in the region. And their hope is that after 2 years at 10,000 hogs per day, they will be able to add a second shift and actually double their processing capacity.
Mm-hmm. So this means lots of new jobs in Mason City?
That's the expectation, 1,000 new jobs when the plant opens 2 years from now and potentially 1,000 more 2 years later.
Mm-hmm. Do we know if these will be people currently in the Mason City area or will people be coming to this as a magnet for jobs?
I imagine it will be a combination of the two. There was a question asked about whether there were enough workers in the region, and the answers from city officials and company officials were, yes, they were certain that the good pay in the jobs, they should start around $15 an hour, and the benefits and the value of the company, et cetera, should be really attractive. But it seems if that's the case, it would also attract people who are not currently in the area. Mm-hmm. So I think it would be a combination.
I wonder, Amy, overall, what's the outlook in demand for pork?
There's been increasing demand for pork. There was a bit of a spike in pork prices in the summer of 2014, but even with that price increase, there was very little change in what people were purchasing. And demand for pork has remained steady or even been increasing as people have maybe bought a little bit less beef. And chicken is obviously right up there, the big three, but there doesn't seem to be any indication that demand for pork would be decreasing, and that increase in demand is partly why producers are eager to be providing more hogs.
Mm-hmm. You said that approximately 30% of the nation's pork is produced here in Iowa. How much of that pork in Iowa ends up being consumed in the nation, or does it go also to other countries?
There is a large and growing export market. That's true for all U.S. meat because more consumers in countries with growing middle classes are demanding more meat. And so we see a lot of our pork and chicken and even, I think, beef being consumed overseas. The export market is, let's see, in 2014, we exported about 2 million metric tons. That's 4 billion pounds of pork and pork products. And so that market is, you know, continuing to grow. It could increase by as much as 14% over the next 5 years, according to USDA, and maybe even 25% in the next 10 years.
China comes to mind as a big market here. Is that still true?
Yes, although now that China is the owner of one of the biggest pork processors in the world, Smithfield, I think there's a combination of China trying to grow its own domestic production as well as continuing to be a major importer of pork products.
Agricultural reporter with Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media, Amy Mayer, filling us in on providing context as well for a North Carolina-based company's announcement to build a 10,000-head capacity hog processing plant in Mason City. The plant will be up and running when, Amy?
They expect to start construction this summer, but it'll probably take about 2 years. So we're probably not looking at anything until about 2018.
Amy, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to some news items that we didn't get to otherwise in our talk shows this week to round off the week. Now, a new study by Iowa State University researchers that shows the vital role information technology can play in meeting the demand for food, especially in developing countries. The new study is published in the journal Information Technologies and International Development, and we're joined now by one of the researchers in this study. Shweta Chopra is Assistant Professor of Agriculture and Biosystems Engineering at Iowa State University. She joins us in our Ames studio. Shweta, welcome to our program.
Hi, Ben.
So, production, we know we have to have that to meet the growing demand for food as our planet's population is growing, but information technology has a role. What exactly did you look at in your study?
So, as we know that, you know, you said that the production is a challenge. By 2050, the world's population is actually going to be 9.6 billion people. That means we need to increase production by 70% and to meet that demand. What happens is all the food which is produced does not reach the people who are in need. In fact, one third of the food being produced actually goes to waste. That is around 1.3 billion tons of food is lost and does not reach people. If we could rescue just one fourth of this 1.3 billion tons of food, we will be able to provide food to 870 billion people who are food, 870 million people who are food insecure. That means one in every 8 person is food insecure. Mm-hmm. And the reason is not the production side, but actually the logistics side. That means they are not able to receive that food. So as my training in lean manufacturing or logistics or supply chain management, what I looked at was how can the supply chain or the process of food distribution can be made efficient, and specifically how information and communication technology can help solve this problem.
Mm-hmm. And you, to do this, you took your home state in India as a study model?
Yes, that's correct. So we studied along with my collaborators in Purdue University, Iowa State University, Government of India, and the Government of Chhattisgarh. Another researcher here, Prashant Rajan, and I traveled to India to see what government of India is doing in order to, you know, make food food distribution efficient. And Chhattisgarh, which is actually my hometown state, was been known as a turnaround state. So this state was formed in year 2000, and it was known for farmers committing suicide and people dying of hunger. And then all of a sudden, now this state is actually known as a turnaround state, which has most food secure people. So that was the reason I started looking into why Chhattisgarh. And what I found out was one of the reason is they have used technology for creating this food security. So what they did was they computerized the whole supply chain, and they're using different kinds of information and information and communication technology for distributing food.
And they're getting it, if I understand, reading some of, about some of your research, that before this technology was used this way, some of the food meant for the neediest people was just finding its way onto the black market.
Yes, that's correct. So it would be diverted. The food, in fact, it was as high as 40%. So it's a, the Indian government spends somewhere close to $13 to $14 billion each year for providing food security to these people who are called beneficiaries. And what they mean is basically their household income is less than $2 a day. So this food will not reach these people in need, but be diverted into black market. So this technology, what it does, it actually creates transparency. And when people know that somebody is watching them, they are least inclined to actually divert the food, but actually be in the system and, you know, distribute it to the people in need.
Interesting. Now, how do we take these findings and further it? How do we apply them even further, make them even information technology even more useful this way?
So we can make the information and technology useful. So basically what I tried to study in my study was, you know, it's very easy to develop information and communication technology. It can be any device. It can be computer. It can be phone. But who are the people using it? And what are the barriers to their adoption? And what I tried to find out was, you know, the salesperson who are going to use this device, what is actually not helping them use it? Are there enough facilitating condition provided by government? You know, they get good training or not? Are the people who they work with, or, you know, their social circle feel that it is good that they're using this device? And is this device actually useful to use it, easy to use it, or difficult to use it? So those are some of the factors which can actually be barrier to adoption of technology. So what we looked at is the salesperson's perception about using this technology.
Okay. Go ahead.
We are actually now making it further and, you know, bringing it back, thinking about how technology can be useful in our local community here in Iowa. We are developing an app to improve efficiency of local community-based food rescue efforts in Iowa City. Basically, it's a table-to-table organization. We are working on developing an app which will help us track the food movement from donating agency to receiving agency.
Oh, interesting. Then I could have an app for table-to-table on my smartphone, and I would open it up, and we only have about a minute or so left, but what would we see?
So, yes, so this app is actually going to be an Android compatible app, and this app will be used by volunteers. So if you know, Table to Table is mostly 110 volunteers who work on rescuing food from donating agency to receiving agency, and what they will see is how much food are they procuring and where that food is going. And this app is going to provide real-time tracking of food, which is very essential in today's world. When there is a recall or any kind of breakout, you can track where food came from and which agency has it, and, you know, you can take immediate action.
Interesting how information technology is used to cut down on food waste and get food to the neediest people in our community here in Iowa, but also in other countries such as your home country. Shweta Chopra, thank you very much. We appreciate you coming in.
Thank you.
Shweta Chopra is Assistant Professor of Agriculture and Biosystems Engineering at Iowa State University in Ames. And we'll come back in just a minute after a short break and more of our news buzz. I wonder, of course, we know LED lights are more efficient, but could they create more light pollution when they're put in street lamps? We'll ask that question when we come back. Also, a spring severe weather outlook with Alan Czarnecki and Ecopolis, where art and community activism come together. It's a news buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment. And we're back with more of this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In August of last year, MidAmerican Energy began upgrading more than 100,000 street lights here in Iowa. MidAmerican serves almost two-thirds of our state. And over the next 10 years, all city street lights in MidAmerican's area will be transition from the less efficient high-pressure sodium lights to these light-emitting diodes, or LED lights. And those lights are part of a green energy initiative. They'll save a lot of electricity, no doubt. However, some astronomers and also amateur Stargazers say these new lights can actually contribute to a certain type of pollution, light pollution. Robert Mutell is back with us, professor of astronomy and physics at the University of Iowa. Hello, Robert.
Hi, Ben.
So how might these lights make it more difficult to see the sky? It's already pretty darn difficult to see some of those spectacular celestial objects.
It is, and it's going to become worse with time. It's just the way it is. But LED lights had a bad reputation at first because they emit more blue light than the sodium lights, for example, or even the mercury lights. And blue light is particularly bad because the sky is actually darker in blue colors than it is in yellow or red. And so the contrast, your eyes are somewhat more sensitive there. So LED lights originally, as when they were first available, were bluer. But now, of course, that's sort of in the last 2 years that has become really not an issue as much because you can buy LED lights in any color temperature you like at this point because the phosphors and the different kinds of LEDs which are in the lights have changed so much that it's really more a question of how many photons, or how much light is going upward as opposed to downward. Mm-hmm. So covering the lights is vastly more important than the type of light you have.
Okay, yeah. Mid-American spokeswoman says these lights are actually better for light pollution because they can be aimed towards the ground instead of spilling light all around. Is there something to that? Do, I guess, the photons, do they go more – did they spread less than the sodium lights or not?
That's entirely a question of the shielding of the light. And it doesn't matter whether it's a light that's a sodium light or a mercury light or mm-hmm. an LED light. It's really a well-designed shield on top of the light because nobody really wants to spend money to light up the sky. That doesn't do anyone any good.
Right.
So if you've got a fixed amount of wattage, you want to put it all down on the street where it's useful.
These LED lights, so efficient, up to 50% more efficient with energy, also lower maintenance costs because there are fewer outages. These bulbs have a much longer lifespan. The International Dark Sky Association defines light pollution as excessive and an inappropriate artificial light. Light that glares and clutters our views. How are we doing overall in terms of light pollution?
Well, for example, in Arizona, which is where on the continental U.S. where most of the major research optical telescopes are, there are very strict light pollution ordinances so that any light that you put up it has to be properly shielded. And that's true in Santa Cruz County where we have a robotic telescope and also true in the entire Tucson area. So Kitt Peak, which is the major facility, has been the major facility for optical astronomy since the 1960s. They have a light pollution problem, but it could be far worse and it's a matter of regulation. As far as I know, Iowa does not have such a regulation, but many places that have astronomical facilities do.
Mm-hmm. So what we as individuals can do is to make sure our lights – I'm feeling bad right now, Robert. I have to admit I've got big spotlights on the front of my garage so that I can play basketball with my kids.
Yeah, sure. I do too. But shielding the light will put more light on the ground where you want it and less light in the sky where you don't want it.
Mm-hmm. The Milky Way. Speaking of young people playing basketball with young people, you talk to young people today, and you know it's not unusual to find young people who have never seen the Milky Way.
Yeah, that's right. I teach a large introductory class once in a while at the university, and I regularly ask students. I can poll them with these electronic pollers, and over the last decade, the number of students who are 18, 19, 20 years old who have never seen the Milky Way has gone from less than half to more than 2/3.
Mm-hmm. And
never seen it.
Okay. Besides the loss of that experience, what is the loss there?
Well, you know, there's
where we are in the universe, I guess.
That's right. You know, the Milky Way, of course, is the galaxy that we live in. And it's not just, as some people think, just some permanent cloud in the sky. It is the cross-section of our home. That's our Milky Way galaxy. That's where we live. And it's a stunning thing to think about that what you see as a cloud is the integrated light from millions and billions of stars.
Okay. The lesson there for us, Robert Mutell, I guess, is to put shields on those lights. Shade those lights around your home and turn them off outside if you don't need them, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, shielding is the key, is the most important thing by far.
Okay. Robert Mutell, professor of astronomy and physics at the University of Iowa. Thank you for dropping by, Robert.
Sure. Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, you may have heard that blare of tornado sirens yesterday as we here in Iowa conducted a statewide drill. It's because Severe Weather Awareness Week is just upon us. It's just passed. We're here discussing that now with Alan Czarnecki, professor of meteorology at the University of Northern Iowa. Alan, welcome to our program again.
Thanks, Ben. Good to be with you.
So the drill, like we had one yesterday, why do we need to do those anyway?
Well, severe weather season in Iowa gets underway here as the spring progresses. Our biggest months for severe weather are actually June and May. And so having some reminders, I guess, about getting warnings delivered to us either through cell phones or weather radios and then knowing what to do with that information is always a good thing to be reminded of, I think, about this time of year.
So to test out the technology, but also to test out our awareness and wake us up from our winter slumber and say, hey, this is the season, folks.
Right,
right. Tell us, what are the basics everyone should know about what to do in case of severe weather? What are some key points?
Well, one of the most important things to know is the difference between a watch and a warning. A watch is indicated for conditions that are favorable for a particular type of severe weather to occur, if it's a severe thunderstorm or a tornado. And so you should be vigilant. You should have some plan of action in case it actually becomes a warning. So the warning is the indication that you do need to take action. You do need to seek shelter. So to have a plan in place for seeking a good sheltered location is very, very important, something very good for us to remember. And basically for tornado safety, you want to be in a small interior room. And by that we mean something with no windows. Lowest level of the dwelling, a permanent dwelling, rather than like a camper or a tent. And to protect your head is also very important. So debris can be coming that could cause injuries, if not death. And so protecting your head. And something that we've learned also from folks that have been through tornadoes is that having appropriate footwear is surprisingly important. When they emerge from their sheltered locations after a tornado has occurred, there are many sharp objects everywhere, and the simple lack of footwear can make a huge impact on how they're able to start their recovery.
It's interesting. Also interesting that within the last couple of years, we have different, you talked about warnings, different types of warnings. They used to be very sort of vague warnings. Now we're getting very specific warnings about the type of damage any storm, particular storm may cause. Why are we doing that?
The National Weather Service has really tried to help people understand the impact that weather is going to have on them. We've been studying, I guess, the sociology of how people process information, and we don't want people to get desensitized, I guess, to warnings and not take actions. And so one of the strategies, I think, for addressing that is to try and talk about the particular impacts that a weather event is going to have on them. And so we've tried to become more detailed in sort of the timing, the expected impact, the action you should take. And I think as we get even better computer models of the atmosphere, we're likely to be able to provide even more specific information to people as time goes on. So especially in terms of the timing, when will things start to happen in a particular area?
Mm-hmm. We've had some beautiful days just a week ago, 2 weeks ago, but this week brought some snow, surprise, to a large part of Iowa. What happened to our weather?
Oh, we had a beautiful polar front cyclone plow through the middle of the U.S. These are actually very common weather systems in this part of the world during the sort of the cold half of the year. And two of the biggest months for these types of storms are actually November and March. And we've had a number of fairly quiet Marches in Iowa over the past few years. If you think back 2012, we were setting record highs in the middle of the month. And it's easy to start to think that maybe that's sort of the normal for March. But March can actually be a pretty powerful transition month and in terms of temperatures. And that's when these storms are most common and when they tend to be the strongest.
Oh, I thought you were going to say in like a lion, out like a lamb.
Well, we'll see how that works out, won't we? We kind of came in like a lion, so I guess if it works out, it'll be pretty mild at the end of the month.
Okay. In the minute or so we have remaining, tell us, do we know anything based on what we've had for winter? Is it La Nina? What the spring and early summer look like in terms of the likelihood for severe weather?
You know, what I did is I looked back at the last time we had a similar situation, and that would have been in the spring of 1998. And in the spring of 1998, we had, in Iowa, I think we had about 78 tornadoes during that particular spring and summer together. And that was actually the most tornadoes that we had had for a while. Now, certainly you can have just a particular pattern that sets up that produces a lot of tornadoes. We kind of saw that last year. We had 19 tornadoes on November 11th. That's very, very unusual. And so that can kind of swamp your statistics then. But anyway, based on the last similar ending El Nino pattern, that spring and summer did produce maybe a few more tornadoes than what we typically see in the state.
Mm-hmm. And very quickly, in just a few seconds, climate change affects our weather, tends to bring more severe weather. Is that what you see?
There are really not good indications that that's the case. Most of the data suggests that the number of tornadoes and their severity have not been increasing.
Okay. Alan Czarnecki, professor of meteorology at the University of Northern Iowa. Always good to have you with us, Alan. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. Good to be with you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River.
I need to shake the leaves loose from the tree. Ooh. Let the fruit fall to the earth. Dig a little deeper, hit up onto the roots. Honey, I need to give birth.
Now, isn't that awful purdy? Well, tonight at the Old Capitol Senate Chambers in Iowa City, this band, the all-female Iowa quintet, the Awful Purdies, will perform an evening at the Ecopolis. It's part of a broader Ecopolis movement that the Awful Purdies singer-songwriter Katie Roche has helped found. It's about rethinking how city structures can impact green energy. Katie joins me now in the Iowa City studio to help understand this movement and how artists play a key role in changing the environmental landscape. Katie Roche, welcome to our program.
Thanks so much for having me back on.
Okay, you're a member of two outstanding bands. We just heard you singing there, leading the Awful Purdies. You're also with the Dandelion Stompers. Tell us what's happening tonight with the Awful Purdies.
So tonight's performance is in the Old Capitol and the Old Senate Chambers on the Pentecost in Iowa City. And it's an event called An Evening at the Ecopolis. And actually, Genevieve Heinrich from Little Village wrote this yesterday in their paper, and I thought it was the best summary of what's happening. So I'm going to read this from her. She says, this is a collection of music and stories based around an original piece created by Jeff Biggers, who's the University of Iowa writer in residence in sustainability. And the thought line is the notion that cities need recentering and that philosophies of ecological justice can underpin the choices we make by local government and by individuals. So this event weaves together narratives and music. And I think it's a really interesting approach because so much of the conversation about climate change is really data mm-hmm. and fear driven. And instead, Jeff Biggers has written this piece where he's speaking from the future and he's looking back and he's saying there was this moment of crisis and Iowa City made these decisions, made these choices, and they changed the future that they live in the future. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really true. I think we have this incredible opportunity right now to make wonderful decisions that are going to change the future for our children and our children's children. And that's really the simple way of talking about what a regenerative city is. You just have to ask yourself the question all the time, how is this going to affect the future?
Regenerative city. That's an interesting phrase here. When we talk, you talked about fear-driven conversations about mm-hmm. global warming and so forth. This is something at a very local level. We can have bickering going on at a federal or international level, but this is action at a local level. And that's important when it comes down to it, isn't it?
Absolutely. What we do at home often feels like it doesn't matter at all. You know, you're composting and you're recycling and you're remembering to turn off your lights, and it's hard to think of that impact in its cumulative effect. Yeah. But it really does add up. But even more so, how can we influence our local governments and work together, work with the University of Iowa, work with the City of Iowa City, other elected bodies, the county, the school board, to help them make decisions that are going to make a big difference. So I've been involved in this movement to try to work with the school board to consider solar energy for our schools. You know, we're facing all of these budgeting crises around education. How could we reduce some of those energy costs by generating our own power with solar? Mm-hmm. And then this diversified student body that we're trying to serve, now we can do a better job of serving them because we're not spending money on burning dirty coal anymore. Mm-hmm. We're actually a power plant at a school.
Katie Roche, talk a little bit more about the intersection of art and this movement, because often, I guess, the art is often there to draw a crowd in. And then you have a little mm-hmm. speech and then you hear a little music. But yeah. The integration isn't quite what you would like?
Well, I'm not saying that like every artist has to be socially engaged or in line with a movement or an issue, but I think when artists are involved in the planning process, everyone involved from the planners to the people they're serving are more engaged, they're more connected. And artists bring a different voice to the conversation. So whether you're a sculptor or a singer, you know, you're in the practice of trying to figure out how to communicate complex ideas through a simple object or through, you know, a 3-minute song. Artists can be a master of messaging. You know, they can distill complex ideas into something that's easier to connect with and easier to understand. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's why we depend so much on incredible journalism, and those artists, those masters of the word, help us understand the world we live in. You know, a great song, like think about like Bob Dylan's Hurricane, you know, that case was revisited by generations after, because the song was so intriguing and helped people understand that an injustice had happened.
It sort of crystallizes the thought or the movement that's right for a certain time.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you hope Iowa City, leading this movement in Iowa City, it'll spread to other towns in Iowa? Has it already?
Yeah, I mean, the idea of regenerative cities is actually worldwide. And the Acropolis idea is spreading. And here in Iowa City, you know, we've had a wonderful response from the city of Iowa City, you know, just in that they're listening. You know, folks from the city are coming to these forums and these events.
Decision makers.
Yes, decision makers are coming to these to these forums and these events. And
what are they saying?
You know, in personal conversations with lots of elected officials, everyone's really intrigued by the opportunities that lie in renewable energy. Sometimes the money really can talk with those issues. You can offset an incredible amount of expenses by generating power through solar energy or wind.
When it makes sense to the bottom line, that's the best reason,
yeah.
I guess, or the most effective reason.
Yeah, and sometimes it's hard to – it feels almost more in the ether to try to argue, well, you know, it's going to be better for the environment, because that just seems like such a big idea, and it's hard to really grasp that. But you know, when you know, in certain cities around the world, when the air – you can't – breathe and they have to, you know, give flag warnings on how bad the air is that day.
Yes.
I mean, that's a much bigger reality. No one's questioning whether climate change is real and whether the way we're living our lives is having a bad effect on the world we live in those places.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Katie Roche, thank you very much for coming in. Let's remind our listeners of the event taking place tonight at the Old Capitol Senate Chambers in Iowa City. Your band, the five of you, known as the Awful Purdies. Mm-hmm. Congratulations, by the way. You've been around 10 years.
Yeah. It's been a great 10 years.
You've been performing for 10 years. We'll perform tonight an evening at the Acropolis as part of a bigger show. How can people find out more?
If you go to awfulpurdies.com, you're going to be able to see that information. And Purdies is spelled P-U-R-D-I-E-S.
Okay. The All-Iowa... all-female Iowa band, the Awful Purdies. Katie Roche here, Iowa City singer-songwriter. Let's go out with one of your originals, Rest These Bones.
Rest These Bones, a tribute to hard work and the farmers that feed us all.
Okay, Rest These Bones from your last album, All Recipes Are Home. Thanks for coming in, Katie.
Thanks so much for having me.
These bones, when the sun sleeps, work's never done. More
The Awful Purdy's there. Once again, they're performing tonight at the Old Capitol in Iowa City as a part of Ecopolis. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon. Also help from Jason Burns and Phil Moss today. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for listening to River to River. We'll talk to you again next week.